Welcome to Driven Radio Show, your home for car talk covering the latest news to the greatest views on the biggest names in performance, sports, and just plain cool driving machines. Let's rev up the conversation. Time for Driven Radio Show.
Hey, all you gearheads and car fiends, welcome to Driven Radio Show, your weekly automotive happy hour. I am Brett Hatfield, here with my co-host and engineer extraordinaire, Mr. Mark Groves.
That's me.
We are coming to you from Driven Radio Studios. Now, last we left you, Mr. Mark,
yes, sir.
You'd finally gotten your hands on your dream Mopar, or at least the Mopar that fit your dreams in your pocketbook. Fill us in on what that was.
Well, first off, I'd like to thank everybody who replied going, you finally did it, and about time.
Yeah, most of us were incredulous.
Every one of you are absolutely right. It is a 1964 Dodge Custom 880. A kind of a surprising, just make it work kind of car for Mopar that filled a hole that they had at the time between, what was it, 62 and 64. Oh, and I do need to say a thank you to our friends from down south at the college, because I got a note, McPherson College, saying, hey, by the way, I was listening to your show, and just FYI, they're not the same engines. Mine's a 361 V8. And it depends upon the, I can't remember what the rise, the deck height. That's what it is. The deck height on 383s came in two different deck heights. There was a lower and higher one. Very early ones and very rare are the low deck heights, which did have pretty much the same engine block, but the higher deck height did not. So I learned a lot, and thank you, McPherson College.
Does that mean that finding parts for this or hopping it up is it going to be more difficult?
Hopping it up would be a problem. Okay. You know, I could probably get a four barrel carb up on the top, a little bit of other things here and there. But otherwise, yeah, ain't gonna happen. I actually went through several bulletin boards and read through, and there was a really good Mopar one. That guy was asking, hey, could I do this to buy a 361? And they're like, it would cost you less to buy a 383, a 413, or even a 440, and just drop it in there.
Hemi.
Yeah. I don't know. I still have some love for the 440, although I would love to have a Hemi. Just for the sound of it. It's just beautiful. It sings. But okay. So it's the 1964. It's an amalgamation of a whole bunch of different cars with a front end that looks like a whole bunch of other different cars. It's red on red, and it's all original. It's 77,000 miles. Everything is original. And it's in surprisingly good condition.
I thought so.
Could smell better. But I also,
well, that's just old car-itis. But last we heard, you'd gotten the thing, you bought it in Iowa.
Yep.
You got it shipped to your house by somebody who spoke very little English and showed up in the middle of the night.
But a good person. He took care of me.
And you got it dropped off, and the brakes were locked up, and it wasn't rolling.
Didn't
want to go anywhere.
Yeah.
What happened after that?
I finally got it into the garage.
Oh, cool.
I know, right? And stupid me, it was like, you know, start a couple times, chirp the tires just to get some momentum before it died. However, when I did, I'm like, I need to be able to run this a little bit, because I had to pull it out again to get the garage door worked on. So I poured, you know, put some gas down the carb.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually kind of ran for a minute there.
Oh.
Yeah. I was like, that's the thing I remember test driving.
Maybe you just got a tank full of crappy gas.
I got a tank full of crappy gas. Okay. I got a clogged up carburetor.
Fresh gas.
Yeah.
Little sea foam. You and I will have to stand on either side, hip checking it, doing the rock back and forth to get things to mix around.
Well, it's going to Daryl Ossipik Thursday morning.
Oh,
yeah. And Daryl, he pulled the same thing. I mean, I talked to him actually this morning. I was like, hey, when do you want this brought to you? Do you want it Wednesday night or Thursday morning?
Never.
And Daryl said, oh, yeah, that's believe me, that is the welcoming feeling I've got. He's like,
yeah,
Thursday morning. Morning's good. And so I'm like, thank you so much. And I talked about, I'm like, I've got a list of things. Do you want me to do you want me to give you the list of stuff, or how do you want to work that? And he's like, let's
just start with the basics.
Just, you know, if you could just leave a blank check on the front seat.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I'm going to introduce you to a phrase that Daryl introduced me to a while back. It's we'll fix it no matter what it costs.
Yes, that's the line.
Yep. Yeah, that's the one he uses on me.
So that's where I am with it. I haven't really touched it much at all, to be quite honest. It's just been too damn cold. And also, I need to buy the right cleaning agents because everything's original, and I don't want to F that up. The interior, I even stopped by a couple of places.
I will be happy to advise.
That is my plan, is hitting you up, especially after we record tonight. And then I am trying to find some type of stereo system that doesn't require me to cut holes in anything. I want to see if there's actually like
Bluetooth
speakers.
It's called Secret Audio. I can show you the website. I had one in the Impala.
I should have talked to you first before we started recording.
There you go. There you go. All righty. Very quickly, Schadenfreude Express update.
Yes,
for those who are not familiar, the Schadenfreude Express is my extraordinarily frustrating 1999 Mercedes S600 with the 6-liter V12 in it. Hugely complex car. There aren't new parts available for it anywhere. Not anywhere. Not anywhere. Not even seat covers. Screw you, buddy. They're not available. Last we heard, I was driving out of the Mercedes dealership in the car, went to turn the fan up on the AC see how it was working because it was freshly fixed, and the stupid button broke. Driving out of the dealership. I got home, started looking around, pulled the part number off the top of the control unit in the dash, and started looking around online. Found them, rebuilt, reconditioned,
yeah.
Lovely shape. $510 was the cheapest
for
I
a plastic
found.
Button.
For well, just for the whole unit.
Oh God!
I had bought years ago. I bought an incorrect unit to replace the one that was in there because I thought that was the problem. I'd just swap them out. I still had the incorrect unit. On the face, they looked the same.
Yeah,
absolutely the same. Went down to the warehouse yesterday.
Aww.
Pulled the head unit. Aww. Pulled the control unit out of the dash. Unhooked it, got the incorrect control unit, brought them both home, sat down at my desk. I've learned something working on cars over the last several years. It took me a long time to learn this. I really looked this over carefully before I tried to take anything apart.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah.
I didn't want to break anything.
Yeah.
And spent about 15 minutes really looking it over and determined the button comes right off the face of this thing. You just pop it off. It just pops right off. It's no big deal. It was a screwdriver and just very cautious turning of the blade. Popped the old button right off, popped the one off the incorrect unit, pushed it in. Bam.
Boom.
Fixed.
Daddy. Yeah. Go post.
100% work. Saved myself $500. And I spent the rest of the night breaking my arm, patting myself on the back.
Oh, hell yeah.
I am so smart. I was doing the Homer Simpson song. I am so smart.
Kiss my ass, Himmler. Look what I did.
SMRT. Wait a second. That's not right. Anyway, just doing the Snoopy dance, man. Head up, feet moving. Couldn't have been more thrilled with myself.
That's awesome.
I got a $500. It's the first real break I've caught on that car. Oh, boy, did I feel smart for about an hour.
Dude, now, are you looking over your shoulder starting to feel paranoid of like, wait a minute.
No.
What's it sandbagging me? What's it doing?
No.
No?
Because I have been so ceremoniously screwed so many times on this car. I was due for a break. For anybody who has ever thought, ooh, that's cheap, I should get one of those, don't. Working on an S600 is an exercise in automotive masochism. It absolutely is. Real quickly, I have to thank Dave Kinney and also Donald Osborne. They were the two gentlemen who put on this weekend's American Society of Appraisers Education Weekend at the Museum of American Speed in Lincoln, Nebraska. I was not feeling great this weekend. I went anyway. I didn't want to wait another year to get all of the information that came out of this.
Right.
But also, man, that Museum of American Speed, that is so cool. And keep a bag packed. We're going.
No doubt in my head.
We are going to go. We're going to go, and we'll probably talk about it a little bit here and also on our sister show, which is going to make its triumphant return. Road Muscle Radio.
Yay!
Is coming back to the airwaves very soon. And one of the first things we're going to do is talk about that Museum of American
Speed.
Oh,
hell yeah.
That is three floors. In a huge warehouse of just fantastic stuff, Indy racers and sprint cars and quarter mile cars and Bonneville speedsters and streamliners and just so much cool stuff. They have one floor that's got a ton of motorcycles on it.
Nice.
And I was going nuts over that. But just fantastic stuff. Want to thank the Museum of American Speed for having us, and want to thank again Dave Kenny and Donald Osborne. Donald Osborne of the Audrain Museum in Rhode Island, I believe. Dave Kenny, who works for everybody over the sun and also publishes the Haggerty Price Guide. And oh, speaking of which, Dave and Greg Ingold should be with us next week to talk about this quarter's price
guide. Oh, I can't wait. I want to ask him how much I underpaid.
I think you did a great job on that. I can't say so in an official capacity as an appraiser just yet, but in my unofficial, I'll call it my amateur capacity, I think you did a good job.
Yeah.
So there you go.
I'm excited to have them back on. That'll be great.
Oh, just absolutely fantastic. Looking forward to having them back on and talking about, are we in an up market? Are we in a down market? I've heard both from people recently.
Yeah.
And also, what's going up in value? What's going down in value? I want to see where the buys are this quarter.
Yeah, well, you know, you can go out and buy a custom 880 for a pretty good price. Although
I'll bet you couldn't replicate that.
I don't think so, because I was looking. And I was looking for, you know, different parts in this. I've got a little lens that's going to need to be replaced and a few other things.
Sure.
And as I was looking around, I'm like, oh, scheisse. I might have stumbled into something pretty good.
I will almost promise you, Mark, that A, you couldn't buy that car again for that money. And B, you certainly wouldn't find it in that condition.
Yeah.
I think you got a steal of a deal on it. Time to get to it.
Yes.
Our special guest this week is Everett Anton Tony Singer. Hailing from Roslyn, New York, Tony Singer is an accomplished artist, entrepreneur, and also automotive enthusiast living in Monterey, California. He is the owner of VintageAutoPosters.com, the premier source for original vintage automotive posters. Tony's passionate pursuit of automotive memorabilia has made him a respected figure with collectors and enthusiasts. Tony created Automobilia Monterey, a staple of Monterey Car Week, for 19 years. He built a new studio in 2008 so he could focus on his first love, which is painting. Tony is a passionate Porsche 356 fan and is a member of the 356 Registry, Porsche Club of America, and also the International Vintage Poster Dealers Association. Tony, welcome to Driven Radio.
Thank you very much.
That's
a lot.
Quite a resume there, sir. You sound like you don't sit still very much. Who were your early automotive influences? Was it someone in your family, father, brother, uncle, or like me, is this something that you just happened upon and couldn't get away from?
I think that my father, way back in the 60s, was into some odd cars relative to the day. So he had a Renault, he had a Corvair, couple of other things, but he had a friend who lived nearby who was an engineer and had a slate gray with red C coupe, Porsche C coupe. And then there was a teacher, an art teacher in high school, who had an Irish green with fawn C cabriolet. And these just resonated with me. I didn't really know what I was looking at, but I liked what I was seeing.
I can relate to that. My father had a 72 green Corvette convertible, and I didn't know much about where that fell in the pantheon. I just thought it was cool looking. It was swoopy. It made great sounds. To a three-year-old kid, it seemed like it was really fast. And nothing was more fun than riding in dad's convertible. So, yeah, I get it. How did you become interested in auto memorabilia and in vintage car posters?
Well, in 1971, March of that year, I bought my first Porsche, which was a 63 Super 90 Coupe in Denver, Colorado, where I was living and working at that time. And during my ownership, I sort of found that there were other things that related to the car. And subsequently, coming back to New York, living on Long Island, and going to some of these swap meets that the Porsche Club was putting on, I found, oh, there are posters that relate to my car. But let me back up just one moment, because during college, if you went to the local Porsche dealership, which was Hagstad, and you walked in, and they knew you weren't buying a car, but they were really nice. They were really helpful. And they would give you a poster. And I probably was there maybe three or four times and had these really cool commemorative racing posters from their victories in the late 60s, had them on my wall seemingly forever until they looked like Swiss cheese, at which point I threw them out. But then at that point, I was also now learning that there were other posters than those few that I had. And that just sort of started this whole love affair.
How did a love of vintage car posters and memorabilia, how did that interest morph into a business? And when did you realize you could make a living buying and selling memorabilia and posters?
This all started off as what I would describe as a hobby, because I was collecting things that interested me that related to my car. And in the 70s, I started fiddling with other Porsches. I did a first Concours restoration on a 550 Spider, which now resides in Ralph Lauren's collection.
Ooh.
And so I was collecting things. And around 1980, I had a lot of things. And it's like, wait a minute, you know, I now have more things than I have either space or interest in how it's broadened. And it morphed into what I would describe as a hobby business. So it was kind of like a little bit of, for me, and a little bit for business. And fast forward basically to about 2002 or three, when I had moved here to Carmel, California, Carmel Valley. And at that point, a lady friend suggested that I get a website, because if you can believe it, for 20 odd years, I was selling posters with a typewritten list. And if you were interested in something, I would send you a print that I had to go to a particular photo store, get a print of what you wanted, and then send it to you. And then you'd call me back and say, yes, that's what I want, or no, that's not what I want. I wanted the other one. But come fast forward to about 2003 or four, and we developed a website. And that site really became really vintageautoposters.com, although it existed prior, because there was some internet presence. But once this site became active and usable, it completely changed the dynamics of you could go on in your pajamas and look at all my inventory, and you could order what you want. I mean, the whole process became so amazingly easy.
Yeah.
And that's what I've been doing.
So you mentioned a couple things that I have questions about. First of all, a 550 Spider. You had a 550 yeah. Spider. And what time period was this?
Well, I at that point, this is 1975.
Okay.
I had a 59 Carrera GT Coupe that I was really interested in a 550, and I traded the coupe to a fellow in Portland, Oregon, who was a dentist and had this 550 Spider. And we did a trade. It was a straight across trade.
Oh my.
And but his car came to me in boxes. Literally, it was the first 550 ever restored that had been taken off of its frame and put back on successfully. And it was a company on Long Island called Grand Prix SSR, meaning sales, service, and restoration. Mm-hmm. And this was a 2.5 year process of bringing this car back to life. And I won numbers of shows with this car. And at some point, a mutual friend put me together with Ralph, and he now owns it.
What color is the car, or was the car when you restored it?
Silver.
Okay, it was silver.
Silver with blue tail stripes. I mean, there's hours of stories about that car and how it became what it was and what it is.
Oh, I'm sure.
It was just an amazing process over 2.5 years.
Okay. Well, knowing just enough about Porsches to be dangerous, you say 550 Spider, and I'm immediately just, I'm excited and I'm enthused, and I want to know more about that. The other thing that you said that gave me a moment's pause, people were ordering posters from you, and you would have to go to a printer and have a print made individually.
No. They would have received a typewritten list of what my inventory was.
Okay.
Oh. This is way before internet.
Okay.
So you would have requested, maybe you saw an ad of mine somewhere, and you would have requested my poster list. I would send you that typewritten list. Then you would say, call me up, or usually call me up and say, listen, I'm interested in the 1966 Nürburgring 1000. Can you send me a photo? So I would have had a photograph already taken of the poster. I take the negative to my photo store, which was a couple of miles away.
Sure.
3 days later, they'd have a print for me. Then I'd send it to you. You'd say, oh, gee, that's great. I'd like to buy it. Or, no, I really don't want the 66. How about the 67?
And the process starts over.
This was a crazy process.
Well, there are certain listeners who, I'm guessing, what, under 35 years old? Or
that doesn't even connect with.
They're not going to understand no digital photos. Everything was a print and a negative, and you had to go to a print shop or, you know, a photo processor to get one made, and they're not going to understand the machinations of the process of, hey, I just can't click on it and make one and you've got it in a few seconds. No, this is involved, and it all started with maybe a paper flyer that they found someplace, your list of inventory. They're not going to understand the process of what you were doing before. And, you know, we've all, for at least 20 years now, computers have made everything so stinking easy. And you can just send somebody a picture, right, and they've got it in a minute or so. Yeah. And they can see what it is. Oh, yeah, that's what I want. Okay, great. I'll go ahead. And they're not going to understand the process. And that's, you know, just reminding people of how involved everything was manual. Everything was manual.
Exactly.
Everything. Many of us are car people, but not all of us have the aesthetic eye to appreciate design the way Tony does. Yeah. How did that develop for you? How did you come to appreciate design?
Well, I've been a painter since I was in elementary school and loved painting, oil paint. And when I went to high school, I didn't like the teacher. This was the fellow with the Irish green cabriolet. I didn't think he had anything that he could teach me. So I started becoming a printmaker for 4 years. And then I went off to college and studied art and painting. All I can say is that I know that I have this aesthetic appreciation for so many things, whether it's painting, whether it's doing design work, designing the interior of various houses that I've owned, and with all of my photography that we'll get to later in terms of one of the books that I did. It's just, I think if you have this passion inside, it finds a way to express itself. And even when I was, my career was in the high-end printing business, and I would use my aesthetics and my aesthetic sensibility to help people determine what was the best thing to do for a particular project that they may have been doing or wanting to do. And many times it would be, well, oh, their advertising agency did something, but it may have not been able to be printed well. So I'd have to really be helping them achieve what they wanted with knowing what my process, what the limitations were.
For almost two decades, you've been putting on Automobilia Monterey Car Week. What was the genesis of that show? How did that come about? How has it grown? And will there be a 20th anniversary Automobilia Monterey?
Back in the 90s, I used to go to Laguna Seca during car weekend. It was a Thursday through Sunday, and there were two fellows there from England who would come every year. I would be literally the first person through the gates at 8 o'clock on a Thursday morning, and I would make a beeline to their booth. And they would invariably be bringing posters and other collectibles. And we did a lot of business over the years. So fast forward now to around 2001 or something, and I was starting to go to Europe also to a couple of the shows that were there, Retromobile in Paris, Techno Classica in Essen, Germany, and then there was one that was taking place in Padova, Italy. And these guys, I mean, we're chatting one morning, and they said, well, why don't you put on a show? And it's like, what do I know about putting on a show? And they said to me, well, you know what you like. You've been to enough shows. You know what works for you as both an attendee, as a buyer, and I think you could do a great job. Well, okay. They planted the seed, and within a year, it was Automobilia Monterey. And it has been this collection of as few as maybe 26 or 7 people as it was last year, vendors. And it was as many as in the low 40s when you had more vendors but wanting small spaces, as opposed to, as it's grown, fewer vendors wanting larger spaces. But it has been the premier event in the United States for original collectibles, all relating to cars, some parts, some various things. It could be photographs, it could be hood ornaments, it could be license plates, it could be posters, it could be photographs, just books, literature, all over the board. And it's been amazingly successful from the standpoint of being a great event for attendees. And we've attracted somewhere between 1,300 and 1,500 people over the last numbers of years. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but remember that everybody who walked through that door and paid to be there knew why they were there and the kinds of things that they could be finding at such a show. Well, this has been a great event for 19 years. And this year, frankly, there were not enough vendors to fill that room. And people over the years have come to expect a certain look, a certain content, and a certain vibe that event has enjoyed for 19 years. And it wasn't going to be there this year. And, you know, Automobilia Monterey is me, and I'm Automobilia Monterey to a certain extent, obviously, forgetting my poster business for the moment. And if I couldn't do it right, I wasn't going to do it. So I just stopped.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah, it's over.
That's a shame, because while you've been speaking, I'm looking through pictures of past years, and there's a fantastic display of stuff here. And I'm as I'm looking through the pictures, I'm also thinking, ooh, I need to find that online. I want one of those. That's really cool. And there are lots of vintage Porsche posters. I assume this is your display, and it's absolutely yes. fantastic. And
one of the things that I did is that even though the show no longer exists, I left the website up so that you could look at the floor plan from last year, let's just say, or you could look at the vendor list, and you could get in touch with these people still and make inquiries about this or that. And I just felt as though it was the right thing to do for all of these people who've been part and parcel of this show for so many years.
Are you going to do something in place of this, or another display somewhere?
It's interesting that you would ask me that, because I'm in conversation with two different situations to do a two-day poster pop-up show in Carmel itself.
Oh, good. You'll have to keep us informed.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm a frequent attendee to Monterey Car Week. I'm a senior auction analyst for Sports Car Market magazine, so they send me out there to cover stuff. And if you're there, I certainly want to see what you've got to offer. You're also an author who has penned a couple of books about car posters. Can you tell us about the books? Are they still available? If so, where can we find them? What was the subject matter? Tell us about what you wrote.
Well, the first book that I did relative to my own material was in about 1984. I published a book of my own photography of Ferraris. It's called Ferrari Beauty and Detail. And it dramatically changed the landscape of photographers and how they approached cars. Because what you were doing, or what I was doing, was I was looking at details on the car, not the typical front three quarters, rear three quarter, or side views or whatever. I was looking at a little hood latch or an interaction of the curve of one thing working with another. And this book ended up winning 6 or 7 prizes for printing, because we developed a process to print Ferrari red. We were the first people in the world to print true blood red color that no one could do up until that point. And then again, in the 80s, there was this book about Porsche racing posters by this author named Lee Wendowski. I think it existed in 3 or 4 languages. And there were color and black and white photos of various posters. And I had learned that they were going to do an updated all color version of this. I think it was right around, I'm drawing a blank on the date, but so I contacted the U.S. representative of the book, and I said, well, why don't you include the showroom posters with this? Oh, no, we only want to do racing posters. Okay, so I just decided, well, if you're not going to do it, I'm going to do it. And, I mean, that's just typical of me. And I ended up doing this really, really great book. It's now in its second and final edition, but what we did, and we're now talking about a different process, okay? Because the Ferrari book was your typical color separations, etc. But with Porsche showroom posters the first 25 years. That's the name of the book. The entire book is direct scanned from a poster, not from a photograph. The end result being that the color in the book is spot on accurate to the original poster. Nobody's ever done this before until I did it. And I had this printed in Vancouver, British Columbia, by a fabulous shop. And I can't remember the first edition, but it sold out. And then I reprinted it and updated it. And it's on my site, vintageautoposters.com. And there are some remaining copies available. And it's a reference point that if one wanted to know what was Porsche doing in those first 25 years, where this would just be a poster that would be in their showroom, and it might be, there's a famous series of four posters called the Sporting Life series, with golf, skis, rifle, but it was in effect the first attempt to connect sports cars and lifestyle. It was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. Oh, the fourth one is a saddle. So these kinds of things were very special, but they weren't given out like the commemorative race posters, because they were just for the showroom. So they're fairly rare, and they're exploring a different side of Porsche than saying, oh, we won Le Mans, or we won this race or that race. It was really exploring the beauty of the car and the experience of having one of these cars.
There, as far as the remaining copies available in the second run, there's one fewer now because I just bought one while you were talking. And part of that is the prints in the book are fantastic and the colors are glorious and everything is really well done. But the other part of that is if you scroll down to the posters beneath it, the first one there is the 911S showroom poster. Holy crow. I had no idea those things went for that. I'll just buy the book. Thanks.
Right. And honestly, a number of people will respond just as you have. Gee, that's a lot of money. But, you know, if I buy the book for all of $60 delivered.
Yes.
I can have that same poster and I don't have to take up wall space.
Well, here's the great thing. I can mail you the book and ask very nicely and maybe you'll sign it for me and send it back. That would be neat.
Did you just order it?
I did. Just paid
okay,
for it.
Well, then I'll sign it before it gets shipped to you.
Oh, fantastic. That would be great. I didn't realize that it came through your physical hands before it went out. The posters you've got at the bottom are extraordinary, right beneath the book on your website. I wish I had the wall space to be able to put all of these up. I'm a PCA member, too. My wife drives a Cayenne right now. I'm still on the hunt for my dream 911. But wow, there is some really cool vintage stuff here. And again, that's why I bought the book. I can have all of them in one shot.
Right. For $60.
Yes. Now, your Ferrari book, out of print, not available new anywhere. There are two copies on Amazon right now. One of them says it is signed by the author. The other just says it's used and in very good condition. But that's it, folks. You can't find them new. They're not out there. So if you want one, you may be able to find a used copy. But don't look for them new from a publisher because they're not available. They flat are not available. Oh, wow. I'm excited about my new book.
Yay!
Recently, you had a display at the 2024 Los Angeles Literature Meet. What was part of your display, and how was it received?
Every year, I'm in the same spot in this room, in this ballroom, because I have a wall behind me where I put up two rows of posters. Honestly, a lot of people come by and say, wow, I've never seen that before, or, you know, they're taken with the image. It's not always a selling experience. And part of what my message with posters and the way in which I market is I like to be able to educate and expose people to what is out there. I'm not a hard sell person. If you like it and you want to buy it, lovely. But it's here. You can see it. You can see everything on my site. You know, it's not like you're charging somebody to take a look at these things. And I even do a monthly e-blast to people on my list. And there's no hard sell. It's just not my way, because I figure there was an expression from a clothing store back east called Sims, S-Y-M-S. And their tagline was, an educated consumer is our best customer. And I believe that. I believe that if you learn and you appreciate what may be there, and especially if you go see some of these things in other places, you realize that what I have is very special. And I only sell my posters professionally archival linen mounted. I do all my own packing and shipping. Things don't get damaged. They are better in person than they are even on my site.
When you're mentioning the way you handle everything and you do all the packing and everything, first of all, I'm kind of curious, is there a rating scale for the posters? How are these rated for collectors? Is there a like new, very good, good? How are posters rated or described?
That's an interesting question, and I think the people who really get involved with rating, so to speak, are maybe two of the major auction houses in New York City, Swan and Poster Auctions International, where they will rate a poster. Virtually everything that I have is A minus to A plus to A. And in the process, let me back up a second. When a lot of times when I get posters, they have been stored away for a very long period of time or shoved into a box, and they get crinkled edges. We call it edginess. Well, when one sends this out to be professionally archival linen mounted, A, you are deacidifying the paper. It's being put on acid-free paper, which has been affixed to linen. And in the process, you can attend to all these little nicks and imperfections. But the flip side of it is that I will not recreate posters. I will deal with minor levels of some imperfections, but when it gets to be too much, I don't buy the poster.
Okay. Two other questions come out of this. One, and I'm not asking you to give away any trade secrets or anything, but how do you go about finding vintage stuff like this? This has got to be really rare, and this is not something you just,
you know, find every day at a, you know, garage sale.
Yeah, this is not common stuff.
That's a great question, and I will tell you that let's call it the source of supply has dramatically changed. And in years past, I could go to some of those shows in Europe. I could be like at the LA Lit Meet or something, and you might find some people who were selling. the market right now is at a what I would describe as a mature stage where most collectors have what they want and aren't adding a lot. And there's very, very little source of supply. Basically, now what's been happening is that somebody might send me an email or call me, oh, my uncle passed away, my grandfather, my father, whatever. And I have these six posters. Are you interested in buying them? Well, you know, I need to see the photos, et cetera. And so that process ends up requiring some back and forth information. But it's that I also buy from other dealers who are members of IVPDA, which is International Vintage Poster Dealer Association. It's a group of about 60 or 70 international dealers who only sell original posters. Now, I'm the only one on that site who is selling and focused on automotive, whereas everybody else on that site in that organization are what you and I would describe as generalists. They have food, they have wine, they have travel, they have trains, they have planes, they have all kinds of different subject matters. But I'm just focused on cars because that's my passion. So what ends up happening is that I will, from time to time, look through what people have and buy from dealers, because the fact that they happen to have, I don't know, a 64 whatever poster, how is somebody going to find that? Well, they're not. They're not. They've been sitting with it probably for years. So I pay whatever they want, as long as it's reasonable. And then I get it. And then it becomes on my site, which is so visible worldwide.
And the other question that popped into my head, a lot of these posters, none of them are inexpensive. These are all very... they are enthusiast oriented, let's say. How do you?
Yes.
I'm assuming you don't just roll them up and stick them in a cardboard tube, or maybe you do. How do you ship them? How do you package these for shipping?
Well, again, we now have changed from a raw poster, which is just paper. So now it is on linen. Mm-hmm. So it allows the poster, and the linen will have usually a border of about 1.5 to 2 inches all on all four sides.
Okay.
So I store everything flat. Okay. I have flat files on the table. So when you have bought a poster, I put tissue paper over the poster because I don't want the backside of the linen to be abrading the poster. I roll it and I put it into a 1/4-inch wall tube, which then gets put into another, either a triangle tube or a square tube, because both UPS and FedEx don't like tubes that roll. So you have, and then they charge you this great upcharge. So you have to sort of, they're double packed. That's the long and the short of it. But, you know, I've been doing this for 44 years. I know how to handle posters. And I can safely say that in all these years, I've not had somebody come back to me and say, oh, gee, my poster arrived damaged. Because I'm really careful. And I know the right materials. And I do everything. So I know how it went out the door.
Yeah. Returning to your fascination with the Porsche 356, you're a 356 fan so much so you created one that the factory never built. Tell us about the 350s. What is it about the 356 that captures your imagination? And how did you come to build your own one-off car?
Back in 71, March of 71, I bought my first car. And one of the things that became clear to me is that these are little jewels. That's what I call them. And they are low in horsepower, low in weight, beautifully balanced, even though they're rear engine. So you have to be careful. Great handling, great road feel. And it just, it became sort of this, the blueprint for me of what I like in a car, this great balance. And at one point I was doing some road rallies, these 1,000-mile drives through California, the California Mille and the Colorado Grand and things like that. And I had speedsters before, and speedster is lovely as long as the sun's shining. If it's raining, it's no picnic. It's no joy at all. So, but I love the shape of a speedster. So, and I had a 59 Carrera GT Speedster, which is a very, very special and valuable car. But this is years and years ago in the early 80s, and it was, you know, all of a $60,000 car. But the reasoning behind this car that I created was that I then looked for a convertible D. Now, convertible D is basically a speedster shape with roll-up windows, a different, slightly different shaped windshield that has, instead of rounded corners, it has almost like a right angle, so that both the window and the top will fit to the windshield. And it's, relatively speaking, weatherproof. But what I did with this convertible D is that I took all the jewelry off of the car. So there was a strip, they call it the speedster strip, along where the door handle would be. And there's a strip below the door itself. And the bumpers would have all of these overriders and things like that. And for my aesthetics, this was disturbing the line and the beauty of the car. So if I took all this stuff off, I was then, in effect, revealing this beautiful shape that was hidden by all this extra stuff. And then this car came with a non-matching engine, which I was perfectly happy with. And I sourced 912 engine and had somebody build up this engine. So instead of being somewhere between 75 and 90 horsepower, we're now putting out 110 to 115. This is not a radical car by any means. And in the expressions of the Porsche world, this is what's known as an outlaw.
Yes.
Because it was not restored precisely as Porsche built it. It was restored the way I wanted it. The interior is like a tobacco tan brown, which took 6 months to find the right leather that was the color that I wanted. Special steering wheels, special instruments, special wheels, special brake backing plates. It just, there wasn't a system on this car that we didn't manipulate and make better, but it still looks just like a convertible D, but just cleaned up.
So you've got a cleaner appearance, you've got better performance, and you know that doesn't sound like a huge bump in power until you consider that car doesn't weigh 2,000 pounds.
No, exactly so right.
That's a significant bump in power, and you said it's not a it's not really a hot rod. Well, yeah, kind of is. that's a good bump in power for something that doesn't weigh any more than that. And what a cool idea and a cool execution. All right. This is the question we ask everybody. I'm hoping you brought a really absurd story. What is the dumbest thing you've ever done in a car? See, he's smiling already. So you know this is going to be good.
When you sent me this question, I was trying to think about, okay, you know, I just got to move this because the sunlight's coming through. What kind of stupid thing did I do? And it's very interesting because I was driving my 63 Super 90 coupe across country, and I was up in Montana going across country. And for some reason that is lost on me now, I decided to make a left-hand turn and go down this road. There must have been something there was of interest. Okay. But there's snow on the ground. Well, my driving my 356 in the snow was nothing new. I knew how to deal with it. Except that I didn't know how to deal with so much snow that it was literally so deep that it was catching the bottom of the car and there was too much friction. So the wheels just were spinning and you couldn't go anywhere. So, I was really frustrated and I ended up walking out to the end of this road and hailing down somebody who tried to help me push the car. We get it out of whatever it was stuck in. He leaves. I thanked him very much. And then I decide to make a 3-point turn to get out of there.
Oh, no.
I get stuck again. Okay. And there's no way I'm getting out of this. I ended up hailing somebody who was kind enough. I think he had a motorhome and backs into this road. I mean, the snow had to be probably 8-10 inches deep. God. And he ends up hooking up something. We jury-rigged something and he hauled me out of there. And it was like, I didn't learn the lesson the first time, but I certainly did the second.
A 356 makes a crummy snowplow.
It does. It does.
Just, yep. And that's why you never ever see them pushing snow anywhere.
Weird, huh?
No. We've been speaking with artist, entrepreneur, author, and automotive enthusiast, Tony Singer. Tony, please tell us where we can find you online and on social media.
Online, my site is vintageautoposterswithans.com. AutomobiliaMonterey.com is the site from the old show. Social media, I'm on Facebook that I post once or twice a week, a poster that's of interest to me. And I think that's about it. Yeah.
Tony, thank you for being with us. Thank you for giving us an education on the vintage automotive poster world. I had no idea that those went for that. I also had no idea that so much interesting stuff was available.
I do want to mention one thing, and I stress this frequently in my emails, and that is buy what you love. The fact that somebody thinks something is worth something, if you aren't thrilled to have it on your wall, there's no point in having it.
Absolutely.
And you know, the some of the prices may seem to be high, and the pre-war stuff is expensive. I mean, there's no question. But I mean, there are many posters that are on the site that are in the hundreds of dollars. Fewer are in the thousands of dollars. And there are even fewer in the tens of thousands of dollars. But the essence of what I have is that what you're buying is original, and it's guaranteed so.
Would it be fair to say that the prices on this stuff are never going down?
I would say that's probably a fair assessment.
So if you like it, yeah, buy it, And it's probably always going to have at least the value you give for it. It might be something you could hand down to your kids or other similarly afflicted individuals.
Right. And, right. And the other thing relative to maybe price, but more importantly, there's something that I describe as opportunity value. And that is just what you're saying. If you see it and you love it, don't expect that you're going to see it again. You should buy what when the opportunity is there, do something about it.
Yeah, do something.
Yeah, this is a lesson that I've learned more than once, and usually the hard way, by thinking, it'll be there in a minute, and you go back and, well, it's still there, but the price isn't what it was a minute ago.
Right.
So absolutely correct on that point, sir. Tony, thank you so very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thanks for allowing me to be part of your broadcast.
Nice guy.
Super nice. Super smart.
Super smart. And also, this is another, you know, we run into this a lot interviewing people. This is another facet to the automotive world that I didn't really know very much about.
You know, I may have been kind of jesting about the whole the kitty thing, although I did have that poster in my dorm room
well,
in 1982.
Now, I had the black and white one that said College Life on it, and it's just this massive detailed cartoon that's got 800 things going on it. And I've been trying to find that poster again for a long time, and I don't know if you can find it again or not.
But I didn't know this whole world was out there.
No, I really didn't.
I feel kind of stupid.
Know, I had posters on my wall when I was a kid. Everybody had, you know, I had Corvette posters and some Porsche stuff, maybe the odd Ferrari. I also had airplane cockpits. It, you know, like, have you ever seen the posters of like a 747 cockpit or a fighter jet cockpit and how complex those are and how much stuff is going on? And I had several of those. All of that said, I didn't have any idea that these vintage posters, first of all, that there was such a variety of them available. Secondly, the ones that are, you know, 50s, 60s, like he said, some pre-war stuff. They're, oh my Lord, they're really expensive. They're really expensive. Yeah. When he starts talking about tens of thousands of dollars, and some of the posters that were displayed on his Monterey Automobilia website, a lot of that stuff looks like stuff you see from shots from Jay Leno's garage.
Oh, wow.
You know, those giant, massive, and I don't know if Jay's are posters or paintings. Certainly he could afford to do about anything he wants to.
Yeah.
But on this, on the automobiliamonterey.com, if you go to the expo photos, let's see here, as I'm clicking through, first of all, the fourth, fifth, and sixth shots all look like they're Tony's stuff from that. It's all Porsche stuff, and it's fantastic. And it shows a lot of the posters he was talking about, the sports posters and things like that. But if you go back to the second shot in, this looks like a lot of the a lot of stuff that's similar to what Jay Leno has hanging in his Big Dog garage, except Jay's stuff is lots bigger. So you wonder if he had giant prints made, or if they were out there and available, or maybe he had somebody, you know, what I've seen done is people will make a negative of it, and they will put that in a slide projector and then project it on a wall and then trace it and then paint it.
Yeah.
And you can replicate these in grand scale doing that. I don't know how Jay did it. Maybe I'll get the chance to ask him someday. That'd be pretty neat.
That wouldn't suck.
But these posters I'm looking at, some of them are circa World War One.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are 50s and 60s and stuff like that. And, oh, man, this is so cool. And I'd love to have some of the, like I said, I'd love to have the wall space to hang all this stuff
on. I'm looking at a blank wall right behind you. We can make that work out.
Yeah.
Just start making it rain, baby.
We may have to surround all these posters by soundproof foam, but
that just adds more charm.
There's some really cool stuff in here, and I'm so thrilled that I got that book. If you don't have the wall space, you can have all the posters. They're just in a smaller format.
Yeah.
But really, really cool stuff. And like I said, I didn't know a lot about this. So I was glad to have Tony on. Tony, thank you so very much for being on with us. And what an education. That guy's been at this for decades.
Yeah, he's been through this a while.
He really knows his stuff.
He did.
And, always fun to talk to somebody who is so thoroughly educated about something that you maybe didn't know much about. It's always fun to get that education. Thank you so much for spending time with Driven Radio. We love what we do, and we wouldn't be able to do it without the support of our listeners. You can find us online at drivenradioshow.com, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Driven Radio Show, and on LinkedIn as the Driven Radio Show podcast. We have discovered that the download numbers we get from our provider represent a small fraction of the listens the show actually gets, and that streaming numbers are not included in that count. If you're listening to the show and you're streaming it, we don't know about it. We don't get told that. And there's a second reason for us to really beg you, please download the show if you want to listen to it. If the larger our download numbers are, the better chance we have of attracting a supporter, an advertiser.
Please make us sexy.
Well, if you do that, then we have a better chance of monetizing this show. Believe it or not, folks, the 5.5 years up till this, we have done on our own.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Come out of our own pockets.
It's an act of love.
Yeah.
Insane, stupid love.
This is not... This has not been what somebody would describe as profitable.
But a hell of a lot of fun.
It has been a hell of a lot of fun. This is absolutely a labor of love. We really enjoy doing this. We very much thank you for listening.
Yeah.
And if you're listening, please download it. Also, iTunes doesn't report jack. They don't report downloads or streaming numbers. So if you're listening one more time, please, for us, download the sucker. We'd really appreciate it. If you got a story you would like to tell or someone you would like us to interview, please contact me at brett@drivenradioshow.com. I am Brett Hatfield for Mopar Mark L. Groves.
Yo.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time here on Driven Radio.